My name is Russell Spatz. I'm an alcoholic. I'm a member of the Carl Gables Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. Haven't found that I have a drink since January 25th, 1981, and it's good to be back here. And I'm starting the steps on Tuesday at the 12-step pass on the 17th. So I'll be here one more time next Tuesday, and then it's off. A little farther south from here, but it's good to be back up here again. I think we left off last. I know I kind of mush these things together and I'm all over the place most of the time, but I think we left off last time on step 8, so I'm going to sort of kind of mush 9, 10, 11, 12 sort of together and mix it up around. I'll sort of go off script, so hopefully some of this will make sense, and it is good to be here with you guys. I know a lot of you guys from their past step series, and it's just good to come up here and be here. Always give me a warm reception. I was doing a meeting today at 7:30 in the morning. Had to get up at like 5:30. So somebody asked me how I'm doing. I said, I'm doing wonderful, but I'm tired. But this always, I always sort of like, it's always exciting to me to try to talk about, you know, what happened in my life. You know, Bill Wilson said to Bill Dodson, he said, the Lord's been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease that I got to keep talking about it and telling other people. So I always get excited. I get a second wind when I get to talk about what's happened in my life. There's a line at the very, you know, as I said, I've been around a little over 33 years, married for 33 years, 4 kids, raised them, you know, grandkids, 6 grandkids, and I really, you know, and I don't know whether anybody does this perfectly, and we all have our deals going on, but I'm a satisfied customer. Most of the time, I'm very, very happy about what's going on. I spent many years before coming to AA and a great many years after coming to AA chasing things, chasing stuff, you know, running around needing to get certain things and have certain stuff. And it's a lot of old ideas that sort of come into play with that in order to try to be okay. And I don't need too much to be okay. I used to know a lot. You know, I was highly intelligent before I came here. I had all the degrees. And I knew everything. Unfortunately, that's all I knew. And as a result of knowing everything and being very intelligent, I managed to drink my life away and drink my soul away and drink my self-esteem away and wind up hurting a lot of people, including my ex-wife, my former wife that I told you about, and my son, and dragged myself out of that marriage. And I came today with 2 neurons working. They were waving goodbye to each other. I didn't have much left. And over the last 33 years, I've gotten progressively dumber. And in the book of Proverbs, there's a great, it has a couple of great lines, you know, written by Solomon back, I don't know, 4,000 or 5,000 years ago. And he says, the fear of God or the knowledge of God, or acknowledgement of God is the beginning of understanding. And it talks about how fools despise, and it gives you wisdom. It's the beginning of understanding. But fools, it says, but fools despise wisdom. And trust me on this, there is a big difference between intelligence and wisdom. What I've learned, and I'm just sharing with you from my gut, basically, you know, some things I've learned in, you know, the years I've been sober. What I've learned is that you don't really need to know much. I used to know a lot. I was very smart. I knew a lot of facts. I knew a lot of things, and I was a basket case. The world is populated by many people that are highly intelligent. I represent people as an attorney who have a lot of money, who are very intelligent, and their lives are horrendous messes. You can just pick up the paper every day and you can see movie stars, you can see singers, you can see comedians, you can see presidents, you can see senators, you can see highly successful, intelligent people with lives that are going into the toilet. You say, how could this happen to them? Because there is and most of the people I've met in AA are highly intelligent people, very sharp, and you want to some extremely interested in their own lives. I mean, you, let me tell you something. I was my greatest fan. Let me tell you, I did not set out to lose. I set out to win, get all the chips. I can promise you, I never took any action or made any decision where I didn't think it would benefit me and I would be the winner. And I wound up on the balls of my ass. So apparently, you know, we have this sort of like, we're like idiot savants. Somehow, you can be very, very smart, but we miss a great chunk of reality. The chunk of reality that has to do with the spiritual perception of what's really going on. And if you miss up out on the spiritual world, there's a spiritual world going on with a spiritual battle going on. If you miss out on that, you only see one part of reality and you're missing a whole other deal. And I missed out on that. And people that miss out on what's really going on wind up estranged from their sons, estranged from their daughters. They wind up divorced 3 or 4 times. They wind up with failed marriages, failed businesses. They wind up with talking to themselves about how, you know, they wind up with those voices, you know, I'm an asshole, I'm a jerk, you know. They wind up with a lot of self-condemnation, and they wind up lonely. They wind up in bad shape. They wind up with 15 years sobriety, you know, but they're thumb-sucking crybabies, you know, saying things, I'm just hanging, their whole life is just hanging in there. And they don't wind up being rocking in the fourth dimension of existence and experiencing much of heaven. And what I've discovered through working the steps and quite frankly, through hanging around people. You know, it says if you want, we have, and you're willing to go to any length to get, then you're ready to take certain steps. And then it says, if you want, we have. Which means what I realized is I developed over a period of years a group of people that were always in my life, that there was something about them. I may not have understood them. You don't have to understand. When you see a person and you admire that person, and you realize that person has some sort of quality or something going on that you wish you had, there's something happening, and you don't necessarily have to understand what that thing's all about. All you know is that you like that person, you feel better with that person, and you wish you had that deal, and I hung out with those people. And I don't think it was blind luck that I hung out with those people, and I want to talk about decisions. I don't think it was like, isn't it lucky that I got my present sponsor, John Glenn, who's got 56 years sober? Isn't it lucky that I got, you know, Joe Snyder for a sponsor? Isn't it lucky I had Bob Sullivan as a sponsor? Isn't it lucky luck had nothing to do with it. It had, because I can tell you this, and this is what, you know, once you, what I've learned is, you don't need to know a lot to have an incredible life. You really don't need to know much. I probably spent 33 years unlearning 90% of the stuff that I thought was absolutely true. And unlearning 99% of the stuff that I thought was absolutely true. There's very little you need to know about life. There's probably only 2 or 3 things that you have to absolutely know. But the problem is those 2 to 3 things that you have to absolutely know, you got to absolutely know. You got to absolutely, there can't be any doubt. You got to be sure of those things. You know, we have a saying in AA. You know what the saying is? It says, take what you like and leave the rest. You ever hear that? Take what you like. That's the wisdom of the rooms. Now, it's a double-edged sword. Mind you, I am fully capable of saying to somebody as I'm 12-stepping them or as I'm talking to them, hey, take what you like and leave the rest. It's a mechanism. It's a tool. There's a time when a person in recovery can only drink milk. He can't eat steak. You know, he's got baby teeth. He can only drink milk. And there's a time for eating steak that he's got to go on. And when you're at that time in your life where you can only drink milk, there's a lot of take what you like and leave the rest. In other words, you take and you believe what makes you comfortable. You just believe and take the stuff that you want to believe and take. And you forget the rest. You leave the rest. The problem is, if you take that to its logical extreme, the rest, the stuff that makes you uncomfortable, the stuff that you don't want to see, is usually the stuff which is absolutely necessary for permanent spiritual and emotional sobriety. And if you don't somehow surrender yourself and sacrifice and listen to the stuff and learn the stuff, you know, the truth will make you free, but first it'll piss you off, you know? What is it? Jackie says, the truth you can't handle. If you don't surrender to that stuff, you will learn about that stuff eventually when the explosion happens. When they foreclose on the house, when the wife or the husband leaves, when you get fired, when you get canceled. You will learn the lesson, but it'll be much harder than if you learn it voluntarily. And that's why it says the way we get a new perspective is by 100 forms of humiliation and final crushing of our self-sufficiency. And some of this stuff that we hear in the book only actually makes sense for us because we are idiot savants. I'm an idiot. I tell that story about my former wife I told last time, who said to me, I was as sober as I am right now. He says, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. 12 words. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. 12, simple, you know, there's not even a lot of syllables in that thing. You come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. Got in my car, drove 3 blocks. The person in my life that was the most important person who should have been was my wife and my kid and my house. She looks me straight in the eye and says, you come home drunk one more time, I'm leaving you. I drive 3 blocks. I get to the stoplight and I go to myself, what the hell did she mean by that? I didn't see it. You know, people used to say to me things like, well, didn't she ever mention anything about drinking before? I said, I don't think so. I don't remember it. Because when you're an alcoholic, even before you come here, believe me, you take what you like and you leave the rest. Before you get here, as the people are screaming at you, as the judge is screaming at you, as the IRS is screaming at you, as the entire world is coming to the end, you know what you're doing? You're seeing what you like and you forget the rest. You don't even hear the stuff or associate with it. You rip up those letters. You don't take that phone call. You don't listen to that person. And you hang out with people that tell you what you want to hear. Trust me, your whole life is take what you like and leave the rest. That's what your life is like. You're alcoholic. You don't even see the rest until after the explosion and after your 3 years or 5 years or 10 years sober. And you learn all this stuff. How could it be at 33, at 40, at 50, at 60, at 70 years old that all of a sudden you know all this incredible stuff that gives you so much wisdom that when you look at it, it's really simple common sense stuff. Why didn't you get it at like 18? Really, you know, the stuff that you know right now, sitting here in those chairs, sober 5, 10, 15, 20 years, even sober 1 year, the stuff that you know now about yourself and about other people that you never even considered before you came to Alcoholics Anonymous, how come you didn't get that on your own? You had the same, you were working with the same brain. We're not talking about nuclear physics here, you know, differential equations or anything. We're talking about simple, it's because part and parcel of this disease is to be totally blind to what's really going on. To be blind to what's really going on. So one of the things this thing has done for me, and I'm still learning, I'm still in the learning stage, I'm still, you know, learning this deal, but one of the things I've seen is from looking back, and sometimes you don't see your growth except by looking back. You don't see how things really played into helping you out staying sober except by looking back while you're going through it. You don't see it, and by looking back, what I see and I look at how the steps worked in my life, which are essentially tools, is the things that are really, really important, the basic principles that I needed to understand and get. In order to understand exactly why things happened the way they happened, and why I feel the way I feel, and why my life has panned out the way it's panned out, which I'm satisfied with. And the last line of the book, you know, I talk a lot about God. I talk a lot about God because God is like the number one most important thing to me in my life. You know, I go to church, I do all that stuff, I do the things, all the stuff that is really encouraged in the big book, and you know, besides the fact that I personally talk about God and I believe in God and all that sort of stuff, I've read it, I've studied it, that's what the first 100 people did, you know, except for a few of them, you know, had a little bit of a problem, you know, they got the committee together, but I've read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, I've read the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've read the book, I no longer take what I like and leave the rest, I've read the whole book, I understand what they were saying. I understand on every page they talk about God, they say see the relation with him. I understand this. I understand that on the last page of our book, page, what is it, 184, it says this. It says, see to it your relationship with him is right, and great thing and great, what does it say? Let me see if I can see. Great events will come to pass for you and countless others. You know, we have a sign in every AA meeting. The sign says, you know, I don't know whether you guys know what the number one commandment is. You know, the Ten Commandments is, it says, love God with all your heart, with all your mind. That's the number one deal. And the Ten Commandments, 8,000 years ago. That was the number one thing in the New Testament. They said, love God with all your heart. You know, that's the number one thing in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. If you don't see that, you need to read it and reread it and reread it and reread it. It's not an accident. It's not a coincidence. They say there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. It's not an accident. Bill Wilson said to Bill Dodson, when Bill Dodson was saying, I was trying to find the answer, why they had this relief, he said, the Lord has been so wonderful to me, curing me of this terrible disease. I've got to keep talking about it and telling other people. It's not an accident. At the end of the steps, the last part we finally end the steps on is really step 11, in a sense, where it says, now that you have this relationship with him, try to improve that relationship and then go out and tell other people. And watch what's. It's not an accent that we say we never apologize. It's not an accent where they say burn the idea into the person's mind. He can get well as long as he cleans house and trusts God. It's not an accent that it says job and no job nonsense. All he needs is to trust in God. It's not an accent that says let no man say he needs his family back. He says nonsense. All you need is a relationship with God. And it's not an accident that it says, see to your relationship with God, with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. It's not an accident, okay, that it says the great fact is this and nothing less. And it talks about the great fact being our central. Our central thought concept is that God is alive and lives in our hearts and minds in a way which is indeed miraculous. It's not an accident that they say at the end of the promises, we finally see that he is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. It's not an accident that it says no human power could relieve your alcoholism, you can't manage your way out of this, but God could and would if you were sought. It's not an accident that they wrote a chapter to the atheists and the agnostics, one chapter called Chapter to the Agnostics, where the chapter could be boiled down to say, this sort of thinking has to be abandoned. Get over it, you know? None of this stuff is accidents. And the million other quotes that I haven't even brought up, this is not an accident. So the statement, it's not an accident that we have a sign in these rooms that says first things first, which I didn't know until I read Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers, was a shorthand way developed by Dr. Bob to say, which was out of really Sermon on the Mount, I think it was Matthew 6, verse 33. Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. And the righteousness, being right standing with him, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all those things will be added unto you. All those things you need, you will get. It's not an accident. But the same thing is said in the big book, where it says, once you make this decision, being all powerful, will give us everything we need if we stay close to him and we perform his work well. Stay close to him. These things are not accidents. As a matter of fact, they're all stating, you ready for this? The exact same principle, and that is the Hickean principle. He is God, and I am not. That's the principle. That's what it says. It says here, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. That's the first of all, we had to quit playing God. He is God, we are not. He's the one in charge. It says right here, this is what he says. It says, it didn't work. Next, we decided that here and after in the strong of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. That's the deal. The entire book is about getting you to the point where you not only know that, understand that, start thinking about it, but you absolutely 100% believe it. So by the time you get to the end of the book where it says, see that your relationship with him is right and great events will come past you and countless others, your entire life is based on that. It's the most important thing. The vertical relationship, it's all about the vertical relationship with him and the horizontal relationship you have with other people. And the sad news is people can come in here and read this entire book and presumably do the steps and at the end not believe that at all. But I get that because alcoholics are crazy. I get that. But I'll tell you something. Listen, for those who have ears to hear here, there are some people in here that have read this book, that hear what I'm saying, and all I'm doing is quoting stuff out of the book, and say, well, that's absolutely clear. How could you not understand that? And there's other people saying, I don't believe what this guy's saying. And I can't convince, you can't explain the explanation. Once you lay it out, you either get it or you don't get it. And that's the bottom line. It's not the steps, although the steps are tools. It's not all the other stuff. This is the stuff that the transformation doesn't come out of yourself. That's why Bill Wilson, at the end of that statement, the guy said, I could see that Bill Wilson was grateful. And he was grateful to God because he gave all credit to God who transformed him. So the bottom line is the transformation that happens in your life that turns you into an individual who is non-upsettable, Even if you have cancer, even if there's hard times, and you'll go through hard times, we'll all go through trouble, that transformation all comes from the Holy Spirit from God. It all comes from, it's a spiritual transformation. It's a spiritual disease. The alcohol is but a symptom of the disease. The chasing after the girls is a spiritual disease. You know, the romanticizing, and if I only had a husband, if I only had a wife, I only had, it's all spiritual stuff. You know, the bottom line is the reason why we chase things all over the planet Earth to try to fill that hole that can only be filled by a relationship with Him. You know, it's totally a spiritual disease. And once the spiritual disease, once the spiritual part is taken care of, everything else is added on to you. And so the bottom line is you don't need to know anything except that. But it takes a hell of a lot to teach an alcoholic that. And the problem, and it's not so much a problem, but if you understand that, if you accept that, then the rest of it will fall in place. And you'll understand what I'm about to say to you. Apparently, in order to have a relationship with Him, and this is not me telling you theologically what you should believe. This is what the big book apparently says. You want to sum it? It's what the Bible says. You know, Dr. Bob in the good old times, you know what it says? It says the book they used between 35 and 39 was the Bible. You know, these are spiritual principles. It says the books that they said were absolutely necessary was 1 Corinthians 13, Sermon on the Mount, seek ye first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, so all the things will be added unto you. Sermon on the Mount, which talks all about the speck in your brother's eye and look at the beam in your eye, don't you know, the four step and all that. And the book of James. And when you read those books, you see every concept in our step, you'll see them in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And one of the concepts that you see, you know, last week when I left off, I basically talked about the eighth step and some people I heard and my wife, and I said, next week we'll talk about nine. So we're going to sort of mush in nine and ten in inventory and, you know, ninth step and things like that. Then I'll do 11 and 12 next week. One of the things that you learn as far as concept is concerned is if you want to have a relationship and you want to improve your relationship with God and you look at these steps, look at step 11, you know, you finally got a relationship. And look at every one of these steps is designed to somehow change you and transform you so you can be in a position to have that relationship with God. Apparently, positionally, God would like to have a relationship with you. Whoever God is, He'd like to have a relationship with you. But, you know, listen. You got some of you guys have friends. I have friends. And I have people that I don't hang out with. Now, listen, I'll hang out with most anybody to try to help them out if they need help. You understand? I'm not saying in that way. There are people that I hang out with. I would like to think, because of my discernment, the people I hang out with, you know, I was told the person I'll be 5 years from now. The kind of person I'll be will depend on the people I hang out with and the books I read. And the books I read depend a great deal on the people I hang out with. You've probably heard people say in AA, stick with the winners. You ever hear anybody say stick with the winners? Stay away from slippery people in slippery places. There are leaders in AA. They're servants. They're trusted servants. You know, you that's how you pick a sponsor. You don't pick somebody who's like, you pick somebody who you think, you know, you're sticking with the winners. You're sticking with somebody who has what you want, okay? Well, just like there's certain qualities you look for in the people that you want to have. Do you want to have a relationship with somebody who's lying to you all the time? Do you want your best friend to be a liar? You want your best friend to be a hypocrite? You want your best friend to be somebody who betrays you? You want your best friend to be somebody you can't trust? You want your best friend to be somebody evil? Well, what makes you think God wants that as a best friend? What makes you think that God wants that as a best friend? If it's not good enough for you, what makes you think it's good enough for God? You know, He wants to be your best friend. You know what I mean? But he'd like you to be in a position where you're willing to change so you guys can have a relationship. You know, if you're married, do you want your husband? If you're married, ladies, do you want your husband to be screwing other women all the time? Guys, do you want your wife to be going out committing adultery all the time? If you have a girlfriend or a boyfriend, do you want them cheating on you all the time? Well, what makes you think God wants to have a relationship with somebody who's cheating on them all the time and worshiping cars and all sorts of other things besides Him? What makes you think He wants a relationship that way? And apparently, if you look at the steps are all designed to put you in a position so that you're capable of having that kind of relationship. that kind of deal. He's got certain rules. I'm sorry, the rules are there. It even says in the book, following a few simple rules. The rules have to do with how you treat other people. The rules have to do with restraining tongue and pen. The rules have to do with, even though you screw up, and you're going to screw up, and we're all going to screw up, it has to do with making amends. It has to do with not looking at the speck in your brother's eye and looking at the beam in your own eye. The rules have to do with, if you do hurt somebody, the problem, make amends. There are certain rules he lays down. And you want to know something? The rules are not only so we can have a relationship with you, it's because he wants you to have an incredible life. Because oddly and strangely enough, if you follow the rules, he knows they're better for you. You don't know they're better for you. He knows they're better for you. And you're going to feel better. And that's what these are the things I've learned in the 30, that now listen, you think in 3 months, in 6 months, you think in the fourth year I was sober, not even a clue. I was doing these things by rote. I didn't even understand what I was doing. I was mad and pissed off most of the time. I was doing hand-to-hand combat with the world. I mean, 25 years, these things started making sense, you know, a little bit, you know? You know what I mean? When I started, instead of following the big book, I started becoming that deal. You change into, you know, it says, all of a sudden, this inspirational thinking that is strange becomes a working part of the mind. You start thinking inspirationally. Start speaking with discernment. And all of a sudden you start acting and living a certain way, in a spiritual type of way, without even knowing it. It just becomes part and parcel of your life. You know, and so it's a different type of deal. You know what it says in this book? It says selfishness, self-centeredness. I want to read some. Selfishness and self-centeredness. That we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms. Anybody heard this before? Driven by 100 forms. Of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in position to be hurt. Now put a bookmark right there. Decisions based upon self, which puts us in position to be hurt. You know, the fact of the matter is that crap happens to everybody. No matter how sober you are, no matter how good you are, you know, sometimes people just die in your life. Sometimes stuff happens. Sometimes you get fired. Sometimes stuff happens in your life that are problems that are not your fault. You understand? But when you first come in here, and maybe for a little while after here, you recognize that a lot of the real bad problems that happened in your life before you got here weren't just that, of course, we come in here thinking we're victims, but it wasn't because you were a victim or it was unfair. That 90% of the crap that really drives us crazy when we first get in here, and maybe even a year or two or 5 or 10 years after, is crap we brought on ourselves by our own decision. You know, because of the people we decided to associate with, because of the jobs we decided to take, because of the stuff we decided to do, because of the phone calls we decided to make, because of the money we decided to spend, because of the purchases we decided to make, because of the places we decided to go to. You find out that 90% of the stuff and the potholes, the spiritual potholes you fell into or bumped into, the spiritual walls, were because you volunteered for that mess. You're the one who volunteered for it. And surprisingly enough, one of the reasons your life gets easier is because when all of a sudden you get weller and you start seeing these things, maybe you follow instructions from your sponsor at first, and then later on you start seeing these things, you stop palling around with people that are unhealthy. You know, Bill Wilson said the next frontier was emotional sobriety. He says our real problem is unhealthy dependencies. We are constantly depending on people, places, and things that are going to snap up and hurt us. We depend on jobs that are going to fire us. We depend on bosses that really don't care about us. You know, we give our lives to things that are unhealthy for us, unspiritual for us, lead us in the wrong directions. We aren't capable of saying no, except for the people that are really healthy, those we can say no to. Yeah. People that want to help us or are healthy, we say no to. People who want to hurt us, they say, absolutely, I'll be there. We're incapable. You know, it's part of the problem about being an alcoholic. It's one of these old ideas, one of the ways we are as far as being alcoholics. And as you peel that off, and as you see that, and as you stop doing that through the work of these steps and trusting in him, because I'm so scared that I was so scared that I was going to die on the street, even though I was a good attorney. I was an excellent attorney. I got good jobs. I was a division chief in the staff. Before I was 30 years old, I tried 15 murder cases. Yeah, I got 50,000 people in this town. You know, hardly any of them has tried murder cases. I tried 15 before I was 30 years old. But I was constantly worried and sucking up to a boss that was hurting me and a job I was hurting me because, you know why? Because I was scared that if I left him, I wouldn't get another job. You know where that fear comes from? That's fear. That's alcoholic fear. So you know what you do if you're an alcoholic? You complain about your boss. You don't move, you complain about... You know the only thing that saved me? God saved me. Because I developed enough faith in God where one day after 5 years of working in that job, I said, you know something? You know, I've been trusting God and He's been helping me out and I've been getting through and I don't know. Maybe I'll never get a job. Maybe I'll starve. But you know something, I'm going to go ahead and quit and I'm going to start my own office and do that own stuff. And you know, whatever happens, happens. It's in God's hands. I turned it over. I was incapable of turning anything over, leaving anything, because I was so dependent upon other people for security. I was so dependent upon that paycheck, so dependent on whether you like me or not. I could never do that. Only faith in God, something I couldn't see or feel, but I believe was there. Even though it was maybe just a seed of faith, help me do that to you. It was so important. It's so involved in all this stuff. So it says here, it says above everything, we got rid of the selfishness of what muster kills us. And then it says God makes that possible. But here's the point I want to make. It says we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based upon self, which placed us in a position to be hurt. And so most of us, we realize, after a while, we say, yeah, this happened to me, that happened to me, because it was my own doing. We stop being the victim, we start saying, I made that happen. Well, you know, I found the converse is true. I found the converse is absolutely true. And the converse is this. Decisions based upon selflessness puts us in a position to receive the blessings. You understand what I'm saying? Decisions not based upon self, but on selflessness, on loving God, on loving other people, put us in a position to receive the blessings. You know, one day I went to a Bible study. I didn't want to go to a Bible study. I just went there because somehow, some way, I didn't want to go because I was scared. You know what I was scared of? I was scared about what my Aunt Joan might think about me, and she's been dead 10 years. I'm Jewish. What's the entire Jewish population going to think about me, you know, as if they're thinking about me, you know? What are they going to think about me in AA? I think if you say the word Jesus, I think you're not allowed to go to meetings or something. I don't know. And I was just worried, you know, because alcoholics worry about shit like that. Because we do. But I've been sober 15 years. And I had decided, I thought to myself, and I said, any decision that's based upon fear is probably not a good decision. See, the way alcoholics think, they think like this. They think, could this be helpful to me? And might this be helpful to my family? I mean, regular people probably say, will this be helpful to me? Will this be helpful to my family? You know what I mean? And then if the answer is yes and yes, then they do it. You know what I mean? They say, yeah, it's a helpful thing, they'll do it. Alcoholics think like this. Will this be helpful to me? Well, you know, the founders of AA did it. You know, I've been reading the Bible and everything like this. Could this be helpful to my family? Yeah, it might be helpful to my family. It encourages church membership. It might, you know, it can't hurt. I'm supposed to be open-minded as an alcoholic. And then the third thought comes in. What will people think about me? And if I think that anybody might criticize me, it cancels out the first two. If I think that there would be anybody who would laugh at me or call me names or talk behind my back, the first two are canceled out and I don't do it. That sounds kind of sick and stupid, huh? That a 40-year-old man would think that way, or a 45-year-old man would think that way. That he would live not his own life or a free life, but a life dictated by not even what others thought. You know, the wrongdoings of others, real, fancied or real, or what he imagines other people might think, would stop him from living a real life. It sounds crazy, but you want to know something? That's what you guys do all the time. That's what we do all the time. Because I know I'm an alcoholic, and if that's the way I think, that's probably the way you thought. That's the way we think. That's the kind of life. You end up dying. You're not even living your life. You've been living the life that you think other people want you to live and how you should be. You know, what a sad deal. You know what I mean? And so for whatever reason, I decided, well, I was going to go ahead and do it. And I did it. I made that decision. I sat next to a guy named John Glenn, a Baptist preacher. And I started talking to him. We became friends. And I found out he was sober 56 years. And when Joe Snyder died, he became my third sponsor. See, that was a decision. You see, a decision that I made to go to that Bible study based upon selflessness and health put me in a position to receive that blessing. Put me in a position to receive that blessing. God will always come through. All things will work out for God as long as you put yourself in that position. So what does this have to do with the ninth step? So, you know, the ninth step, and I want to talk a little bit about ninth. It's also going to have a little, I'm going to give you some testimony here about the ninth step. You know, sometimes, usually when I talk about the ninth step and the tenth step, when I talk about the tenth step, I like to talk about the idea, the concept of continuing. I'm not going to really go into continuing. I mean, to me, the big thing about the tenth step is continuing, the idea of continuation. Because whenever anybody drinks or slides back, it's because they usually stop continuing. And I have a whole idea as to why that happens, you know. You know, a lot of people think, well, why do you drink that? Well, he stopped going to meetings. You know, that's a comfortable way. It really puzzles you. You wonder, well, why did he drink? Well, he stopped going to meetings. He said it. He said, I stopped going to meetings. And that's why. So you stop going to meetings, you drink. But, you know, that's not. You know, the truth of the matter is, so you say to yourself, this is what you say. You say, well, I'm just never going to stop going to meetings. But what you don't realize is that same guy who just picked up a white chip who said he stopped going to meetings, 5 years prior to that, he was sitting in the position you were sitting in, and he heard the same thing said by somebody else, and he said, well, I'm just never going to stop going to meetings. So just making a thing, I'm going to stop drinking, I'm never going to stop going to meetings, ain't going to stop you going to meetings. Ain't going to stop you from stop going to meetings. So the bottom line is, the real question is, why did he, after listening to the same thing you listened to and making the pronouncements, I'm never going to stop going to meetings, why did he stop going to meetings? I know many people, quite frankly, most of them I don't remember. Some guy came up to me and he said, today, he had slipped and slid, and he came back after 5 years. He was in. He says, do you remember me? And I said, no. I mean, I was trying to hurt my feelings. I said, no. You know, I said, no. He says, yeah, 5 years ago I was here. And then I said, listen. I said, Joe, I said, I love you. I hope you're the best. But I got to tell you something. The only people I remember are the people that I see all the time. I don't remember all the. I said, listen to me. If I had to remember everybody who came in here who left, my brain would explode. I mean, I wouldn't have any room left. You know what I mean? The only people I remember are the people that I see all the time. You know, I don't remember the people that left 5 years ago. You know, I think it's pretty cool with alcoholics. They come in 5 years, you remember me? Yeah, we had a conversation 5 years ago, you know. That's not cool. But, you know, so why, but how does the God thing claim to continue? You see, if continuing is based upon like a jail cell type of theory. In other words, if you're going to meetings and you're helping people, and you're sponsoring people, and you're doing this thing like you do jail time. One day at a time, click. One day at a time, click. One day, 20, you know, it's like 28-day program, 27, 26, 24. If you're counting days, you know what I mean? After a while, it gets awfully boring. But if you love, if you somehow develop a faith in God, and it becomes a total part of your life, and you're so grateful to him for getting you sober every day you wake up, and you want to please him and do what you please him, just like you'd want to please anybody that you love and you care about, and you believe that he wants you to go to meetings and he wants you to help other people, and that's the kind of life he wants you to lead, not because of yourself, because it pleases him and you actually believe in him, you'd be surprised how you can continue. It's the glue that holds the whole deal together. You know, faith in God, faith is what holds this whole thing together, faith that works. So I'm going to tell you two or three stories, you know, that's what we have time for, and a little something about these stories about ninth and tenth step. I had a secretary. They're sort of mixed up, ninth step stories and tenth step stories, but I'll tell. I had a secretary that I was working for a law firm. Very, very sharp gal. She was English, you know. She had that English accent. You know, just if you have an English accent, you sound brighter than everybody around the place. And one day, I went up to a nice-looking gal, English accent, you know, very high class, very classy, you know. So one day I went up to her, and I shared her with the senior partner. And I'm going to mention the F word now because it absolutely, I'm going to have to do it because it's part of the story. It's not because I want to do it. It's not because I'm excited or, you know, I'm dropping an F-bomb, but it's part of the story, okay? And you'll understand when I hear it. So I went up to her. I had something I had to do. She was our secretary, and she took dictation and stuff like that. So I went up to her, and she was on the phone, on one of those swivel chairs. She's on the phone. And she was on the phone, obviously, with a friend during working hours, you know, and she was saying things. And I was sitting there. I needed to get this thing done, and I was standing there. And she was, like, on the phone, and I was, like, right in front of her looking at her. And I heard what she was saying. She's saying, oh, and then we went to Elliot Key, and Frank was there, and he had this new bathing suit I brought him, and he was so cute in the bathing suit. And I sat there. I was obviously, had a pad. I was waiting for her. And after this went on for 5 minutes, you know, I was sober. I was patient. But after 5 minutes, I went like this. I went, you know? And she swiveled her chair around, and she said, Doris, you know, I'm so sorry, but there's a pest here that won't leave me alone. At which point, I went around and I said this to her. I said, if you don't get off the fucking phone, I'm going to take that cord and I'm going to wrap it around your neck and beat your head. Which I believe, I had about 3 or 4 years, which I believe... Oh, it just pissed me off, you know what I mean? Now, I believe as an alcoholic, you're perfectly entitled to do stuff like that. You're entitled to, I call it pulling the psycho cord, you know, going postal. You need to go postal every once in a while just to get a little respect, you know what I mean? You always want them walking around thinking, well, he looks okay, but he could be postal any second, you know what I mean? You want to have, like, a little respect for you, you know what I mean? And she got off the phone. So I'm walking downstairs after I did my thing, you know, and I'm walking downstairs and I'm, you know, I'm doing the thing in my head, you know, that thing you do in your head after you have something like that happen. She said this, I said that, you know, bitch, you know, blah, 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 you know, blah, 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 yeah, 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 and I'm going nuts. And then, you know, the bad part is I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, which really screws up your hating people. You know what I mean? Because in the middle of that bullshit, I heard this thing, promptly admit it, when you're wrong, all this, you know. It's just, it really so screws you up, you know what I mean? I tried to ignore it. I tried to make it wasn't there. Justify, whenever you're disturbed about the cause, there's something wrong with you. Justify, what about your justifiable anger? Because I, you know, there's nothing justified. I mean, I'm the resentment, number one. It's like this stuff is crap. It's crap, eh? It's crap when you're working on a really vengeful hatred kill 'em deal, you know? And you know, because I really was upset because I knew if I love this deal and I love this program, I knew the deal. I knew I was going to have to apologize to her. Apologize to her. I was going to have to go up to this English bitch, you know what I mean? Who really deserved to be burned at the frickin' stake, you know what I mean? For pissing off the almighty me, you know? And I had to apologize to her, and I had to do it promptly. Before, I mean, maybe in 1,000 years I might have been able to do it, you know? After I killed her, you know? But so I went up there and I said, Valerie, her name was Valerie. I said, Valerie, she says, yes. She says, I just want to tell you I was sorry. I said, you didn't deserve that. I shouldn't have said that. I was wrong and I was sorry. I'm sorry. And she looked at me and you know what she said? She said, I'm sorry too. I was wrong. She said, you know, I could have been in bar that night having a drink talking about that bitch secretary of mine. But I was at home with my kid playing with them because she wasn't even on my mind. You understand? And when she's not on my mind, she doesn't cloud out God and my thoughts about God and other things. And so that story isn't even, she is not even, that deal is not even important to me. The only thing that deal is that's a story I tell at AA meetings to try to help other people. That's all that thing is for me. It could have been a drink. It could have been a horrible situation. It could have blocked out the sunshine of the spirit. And all that is a story. You know? And you think Russell Spatz would have done that or thought about that? That's something that God says he wants me to do. That's Sermon on the Mount stuff, you know? That's a different way of life. So one day, I'm with my 10-year-old son, Andrew, and we're driving to Publix to buy something, and I don't have any money. And so I go to cash a check, and I go to the bank, and the lines, they have the tellers are open, but the lines are like, there's like 20 cars in each line. I mean, it's a good half an hour to wait to get up there, if maybe more. And I notice that there's a line, there's a teller that's completely vacant. There's no cars. And above the teller, it says commercial customers. And I happen to have a commercial account with that bank. I mean, I am a lawyer. I have my trust account there. I have my operating account there. You know, Spatz Law Firm. I got everything there, you know. And so I, you know, have the brilliant idea, which is true. I mean, you know, I understand the legality of the whole thing. Commercial customers. I am, in fact, a commercial customer. I have a commercial account. I pull in there. I give her my check. There's some 18-year-old kid there, young lady. And she says, excuse me, sir. I said, what? He says, this is a personal check. I said, yes, yes, but I'm a commercial on Spatz Law Firm, Russell Spatz. I'm an attorney. I mean, obviously, she didn't know who I was, you know, and I'm an attorney. I have a trust account here. I have an operating account here. My law firm has an account here. He says, that's a personal case, but I am a commercial customer in this commercial line. He says, no, sir, this is only for commercial transactions. You're going to have to get in that line there. I said, don't you understand? I have a commercial account. I am a commercial client. He says, yes, sir, but it's only for commercial. He says, do you know who I am? I have a law, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he says, yes, sir, but apparently she wasn't, I guess she probably knew who I was. She said, yes, sir, but we couldn't. And then I start with this crap. I say, what's your name? You know what I mean? I'm writing down her name, you know, and all that sort of crap. Just so I can totally ruin her day, you know. Beating up on the 18-year-old, you know. And she's like, you know, and I just whiz away, you know. And we go to Publix, and I don't know, maybe I buy whatever I buy. And, you know, I'm thinking about this gal and whatever. And my son, I'm not even paying attention to him. I can't believe that this is happening, you know. How can they, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I was right, and she's wrong, and as I'm driving back, you know, this crazy book stuff, AA stuff, starts occurring to me. And I pull into the bank, up to the thing, gal again. Because I couldn't get it off my mind. It was killing me. I knew what I had to do. And I pull up to her and I say, hi, you remember me? He says, yeah. He says, I just want to apologize to you. I was wrong. And I drive away. I get home. I'm in my bedroom, you know, doing something. And I hear my son, my 10-year-old, 11-year-old son, on the other side of the house, but I can hear him talking to my wife. And this is what I hear him say. And then Dad went back, and he went and he apologized to that gal. He said he was sorry. And he's like all excited telling the story. Kids watch. Kids watch. The kids are watching. They watch you. They watch what you do. It affects them. Big time. You know, I'm the worst father in the world. Listen, this is the amazing thing about alcoholism, about seek ye the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all things will be added to you. You'll get everything if you seek him first. I went to an AA meeting. Some old-timer said when I was 2 months sober, I put God and AA, my sobriety, number one before everything, before my wife and kids. I said, this guy is flipping crazy. Any good alcoholic knows that your job comes first, your wife is like right up there somewhere, you know, and all of a sudden, what is it? He says, because without God and AA and my sobriety, I don't have my wife, I don't have kids, I don't have anything. And it started to sort of make sense, as you know, as it kind of does when you got 2 or 3 months. It sort of made sense. I sort of understood it, but not totally bought into it yet. You know, here's the interesting thing. I put AA and God and my sobriety before my kids and my wife almost all the time. Every once in a while, I'll, you know, compromise. I'll do things for special. But most of the time, I'm either in meetings, I'm here's the weirdest thing in the world. And I'm not saying it's anything wrong. We're all sort of different, I guess, or whatever it is. I get guys that come in here and they put their wives first because they somehow want their wife to like them. They want to do this. They won't go to, they make the excuse to go to AA meetings because they have to go with their wives, and they end up getting divorced. I get guys that put their kids first. They end up having the kids that hate them. Now, here's the crazy thing. I put AA in my sobriety first because, you know something? Children need sober daddies. I put AA in my sobriety first. And God first. And you want to know something? I got four children that love and respect their father. I got a wife who's been I'm married to for 33 years who respects me and loves me. Now she gives me shit. You know what I mean? Well, she's a member of Al-Anon, our ladies of perpetual revenge. You know, she knows how to do an Al-Anon 10-step. When I'm wrong, she promptly admits it. But here's the deal with my wife. Here's the deal with my wife. And they'll battle. Let me tell you something. You'll be battled over it. You'll go to an 10 years sober. Let me tell you something. I get out of my bed every Thursday morning at 6 o'clock in the morning to get dressed, to go get the bagels for the Thursday morning Bible study. Every Thursday morning, I've been doing that for like 15 years or 16 years. Every Thursday morning, okay? Every Thursday morning, my wife says the same thing. Where are you going? Where are you going so early? Every Thursday morning, I said, the same place I've been going for 15 years, to the Bible study. I can't believe you. You know what I mean? Where are you going? I'm doing another step series. Again with the step series. You got to, you understand? Now, here's the deal. Well, let me tell you the deal. Here's the deal. She's giving me shit for every meeting I go to. You want to come to the meeting with me? Ah, listen to your bullshit again. You know what I mean? I don't even make crap. You ought to let me tell the story, you know? I'll tell them the real truth, you know? You know, and... Oh, Lord. And so, but here's the deal. You know, here's the deal. This is what I want to tell you. So I hear her the other day, she's on the phone with one of her Al-Anon sponsees, you know, one of her Al-Anon people, you know. And she's talking, she says, oh, Russ, you know, he's at another one of those meetings. So he's always doing those meetings and AA stuff and everything like that. But I can't explain to you, you got to understand the tone of her voice. She was like bragging. She was not telling it like in a hateful way. She was saying, you know, he does all these meetings, he does all this. She was like she was proud, but she was complaining. She goes, she has a way of doing that. She can, even when she's proud and she's happy, she sounds like she's complaining. You know what I mean? I got to make sure she doesn't hear this tape, by the way. You know? But she'll know I'm on to her. But she knows I'm on to her anyway. But, you know, the bottom line is they watch this. They watch consistency. They watch integrity. They watch whether or not you're a hypocrite or not. They watch whether you put your money with your mouth with. They respect, people respect people. You know, they don't respect, the money is not what respects them. The sex is not, the hands are, you know, they respect people like Mother Teresa. You know, who the guy followed around from the New York Times while she was doing her stuff. He says, I wouldn't do this for $1 million. She said, neither would I. You know what I mean? People respect, the people that gain the respect, the leaders in A, the leaders. You know how the leaders are defined? As trusted servants. People respect servants, people who serve. You think alcoholics think that? They think people respect people who have fast cars. A lot of money. You know, and here we respect people that serve. You know, seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness. See to it in relation with him is right, and great events will come to him, to you and to countless others. Now, I don't have time to tell all the stories. I'm not going to do that. But what I'm trying to say to you is that all these things that we do in here, every step pushes us forward into the next step. And all the steps are designed, really, so that we have a greater faith in God. We're closer to him, so his spirit can work wonders in our lives, and we can change and we can be transformed. And make those incredible selfless decisions that's going to put us in position not to get retribution, but to get the blessings. That's how you get the blessings, by making decisions that are decent decisions, godly decisions, to get the blessings. So thank you very much. God bless you all.